and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss, by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book of the collection, 40,000 Miles Around the World, and we're on chapter 21. This is the 15th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 21. Nelson and the Tillicum as a mailboat, and Pelorus Jack. On leaving New Plymouth, we again rounded Cape Egmont and crossed Cook Strait to Nelson, a distance of about 120 miles. Cook Strait this time was on good behaviour, and with a moderate northwesterly breeze, we sailed across it in a little less than 24 hours. Nelson also is a fine town, located at the head of Blind Bay and encompassed by high hills and mountain ranges. It possesses a pretty harbour, whilst the climate is excellent. While in the South Pacific, the Tillicum had on various occasions carried mail matter from one island to another, but along the coast of New Zealand, the people made her a regular mailboat, for curiosity's sake, as will be well understood. And not only mails addressed to New Zealand ports were entrusted to our boat, but also many letters destined for Europe. Nelson was no exception, and we had a considerable mail taken on board here, mostly for Europe. The Tillicum was almost ready for sea when an elderly, well-dressed lady brought down a tin box of ample dimensions and asked me to take it along to the Cocos Keeling Islands in the Indian Ocean, having been informed that our course lay that way. "Madam," I protested, "you will please pardon me, but the box will take up too much space in our small vessel." She then begged and pleaded with me, confiding that she had a son living on the islands who was employed in the British cable service, and that the box contained a fruit cake which was intended for a birthday present to him. My mate happened to be standing nearby, and on hearing fruit cake, later on he gave sufficient evidence that he liked fruit cakes quite as well as the ladies, whispered into my ear, "Take it, Captain, take it, by all means take it along." And as the good lady at the same time was appealing so insistently on behalf of her beloved son, I finally agreed and promised to do my best to deliver the parcel. My acquiescence nearly brought the tears into her eyes, and to show her thankfulness, shortly before we sailed, she sent on board another cake for the entertainment of the crew of the Tillicum. Buckridge said that the second cake was to pay freight and insurance on the first one, but also sarcastically remarked that if fruit cakes were as scarce in the Indian Ocean as they were at the South Pole, something might happen to the mail before we reached the Cocos Keeling Islands. "Look here, Buck," I was wont to abbreviate his name for convenience's sake, "broaching cargo is prohibited on board the Tillicum." Leaving Nelson, we sailed by way of the French Pass for Napier, which is situated at the east side of the Northern Island, at a distance of about 300 miles. French Pass is the name given to a narrow strait separating the little island d'Urville from the main island, which here forms a small peninsula, some 30 miles out of Nelson. French Pass is remarkable for the tremendously strong tides that rush through it at a rate of about 9 miles an hour. It has further gained notoriety as the home of Pelorus Jack, the most wonderful fish in the world. This curious creature has a reputation for coming alongside every vessel passing the strait. It will accompany her for from 5 to 20 minutes and then disappear again into the deep. Having heard a good deal about Pelorus Jack's peculiarities, we anchored on the west side of the strait to wait for slack water with the turning of the tide, as nearly all vessels intending to make the passage do. It was a beautiful morning when we got underway at high water, and with a light westerly breeze sailed through the narrow pass. We kept a sharp lookout for Jack, but he failed to put in an appearance. We cruised about the place where he is wont to make his calls, but were not honoured with a visit. Needless to say, the crew of the Tillicum felt highly insulted at this neglect. On the east side of the pass, we observed a nice little house, and as there was a good landing nearby, we ran the boat up the sandy beach, and I jumped ashore. On walking towards the house, I was met by a gentleman who introduced himself as Mr. Brown, proprietor of the dwelling and the surrounding countryside. Mr. Brown said he had met me a few days previously at Nelson, but as I was introduced to so many people in ports of call, I did not recognise his face at once. Now we renewed the acquaintance. I told Mr. Brown that I had heard of Pelorus Jack, and also of our vain endeavours to discover him, which had lasted for 2 hours. I added, furthermore, that in my opinion, New Zealanders were pretty good storytellers. "It is a fish story, all right," Mr. Brown replied, "but nevertheless a true one. Jack calls on every vessel that goes through the pass and accompanies it for some time, with the exception of a certain steamship from which he was shot at. Ever since, he has never been seen from the same vessel. Neither will he acknowledge small vessels, such as yours." "That uncivil, self-conceited fellow," I said. "Nearly every man, woman and child, including the Honourable R. Selden, Premier of New Zealand, has come to see my little vessel, and this Pelorus Jack flatly refuses to pay any attention to her at all." "That question you must settle with Jack direct," Mr. Brown replied. "But if you want to see him, wait till tomorrow when a steamer will pass through, and then he is sure to come alongside her." Of course, I at once made up my mind to avail myself of the opportunity. At 10 o'clock the following morning, a steamer indeed entered the pass eastward bound, and Mr. Brown took us off in his launch. Shortly after we got aboard and she had emerged from the narrows, a large fish of whitish colour made its appearance alongside the passing vessel. "There he is," came the yell from every passenger's lips. They crowded the deck and stretched their necks over the rail to obtain a glimpse of this unique fish. Pelorus Jack first appeared about 15 feet off the starboard quarter and went full speed ahead, gliding along in front of the steamer's bow, where he remained for a few minutes. Thereupon he made a dive under the vessel's bottom and showed up again off the port side, nearly abreast of the bridge. It was quite a sight in itself to watch the passengers, old and young, rushing about the deck to the various places whenever Jack performed his tricks. Jack kept up his manoeuvres for about 15 minutes and then suddenly disappeared from sight. This far-famed wonder derives his name from the beautiful Pelorus Sound, which forms the northern extremity of central New Zealand. This great and picturesque inlet branches into numerous arms and creeks, embracing altogether some 250 miles of coastline. Its waters are deep and sufficiently extensive to accommodate large vessels. There are said to exist 30 landlocked anchorages in all. French Pass constitutes the westernmost part of the sound, which Pelorus Jack has made his home, according to the natives' legend, many years before the arrival of white men. Pelorus Jack is classed by zoologists as a dolphin, and thus in reality is not a fish but a mammal, for which also his highly developed instinct and cleverness account. He measures about 15 feet in length, his colour is nearly white, with a little admixture of grey and yellow, and an additional decoration of brown stripes. Jack shows a large head and massive shoulders, while the body tapers towards the tail. He possesses a scythe-shaped dorsal fin and a large horizontal tail, the latter very much resembling that of a finback whale. The animal is marvellously speedy and will play around a steamer travelling at a rate of 14 to 15 miles an hour, overtaking her with apparent ease, as if she was standing still. This wonderful creature serves as an attraction and doubtless forms an economic feature in New Zealand, drawing yearly crowds of holidaymakers and foreign tourists. Jack has thus become a foremost money-making concern and one of the wonders of the world. His equal in habits and colour is unknown, and his life is protected by the New Zealand government. As Pelorus Jack is the only known specimen of his kind, he is much esteemed by the population of New Zealand. He is treated with almost the same respect as a human being, and anyone guilty of detracting from his character is liable to get himself into trouble. About a year ago, while making along Main Street in Yokohama, I happened to come across a passerby who wore a downhearted look on his face, and whom I at once recognised as a New Zealander by his watch charm. It should here be mentioned that a green stone is found in New Zealand, which is manufactured into a variety of ornaments and takes a high polish. Usually it is mounted in gold and extensively worn by the people of that country. I addressed the gentleman and discovered that I had made no mistake. The interest I take in New Zealand generally is due to the splendid reception I received during my stay in that country, although I have, in this regard, no reason for complaint anywhere. On this occasion, upon inquiring how things were at home, I was told that the people of New Zealand were heartbroken, and flags had been flying half-mast when he sailed from Wellington. "What is the matter?" I inquired. "Did the governor die?" "Not that," the stranger replied. "A governor can always be replaced, but Pelorus Jack cannot, and he has abandoned his call and is given up for dead. Since then I have heard that the great fish had been missing for some time, but fortunately turned up again. Evidently, Jack had thought that after many years of continuous service, he was entitled to a vacation, which could not but be beneficial to his health. And my readers will agree with me that no one should blame the faithful old pilot. Chapter 22. Historical Reminiscences and Auckland, and the Ambitions of Mr. Buckridge, and Engaging a Fresh Mate. The weather was fine when we sailed from French Pass in the latter part of June, with a moderate westerly breeze, and shaped our course across Cook Strait towards the southern end of the North Island. Cook Strait, during the winter months of May, June and July, is frequented by heavy southeasterly gales, but we were favoured in that respect, and the steady westerly breeze stayed with us until we had rounded Cape Palliser, the southernmost point of the North Island. Then the wind hauled into the south, and as the weather continued fine, we made good headway, following the coast towards our next port of call. However, when we reached Cape Kidnappers, we got becalmed and drifted about for 24 hours near two white rocks, which looked very much like haystacks. Its name was applied to the cape by Captain Cook on his first exploring voyage, when many natives came off in a large canoe and tried to kidnap a little boy from his ship. Some of the natives lost their lives in that adventure. The following day, the wind came in from the east, and with its help, we sailed into the little harbour of Napier. Here we remained for 10 days, and after receiving a considerable consignment of letters for Europe, we set sail for Auckland. It was late in the evening when we sailed out of Napier Harbour, and when just clear of the land, a fresh southeasterly breeze, accompanied by a short choppy sea, made the Tillicum jump into the waves up to the foremast. Shortly before we left Napier, some of our hosts had treated us almost too kindly, and by urging me to have another one, just one more, "I am sure you can stand another small bottle, Captain," they had greatly overestimated the capacity of my stomach and caused me to stow away more than I was accustomed to. The latter, however, revolted and was not satisfied until I relieved it from the extra pressure. My mate, Buck, showed his sympathy by saying, "Well, that serves you right. An old salt like you should know better than to get seasick in a little blow." During the night, we crossed Hawke's Bay, which is about 40 miles wide, from Napier Harbour to Portland Island, arriving at the latter place towards morning. A strong easterly wind made it difficult for us to weather the island, and we therefore anchored under the shelter of the west coast of Mahia Peninsula, beyond it, in smooth water. There we lay waiting for more favourable wind and weather, and incidentally for my stomach to get into a seaworthy condition again. Towards evening, the wind hauled into the northwest, and we resumed our voyage to Auckland. After rounding the point, we shaped a course northward, and with a fresh breeze off the land, followed the coastline until next morning, when it hauled into the northeast, resulting in a dead headwind. We then put the boat on the starboard tack, and when under land, we got becalmed near Poverty Bay. While we drifted about and waited for wind, a canoe and three native men and women came alongside. One of the men, who had a good command of English and acted as the speaker, offered his services as pilot to tow us into Poverty Bay for the sum of 10 shillings, promising to conduct us to the very spot where Captain Cook had anchored on his discovery of New Zealand. I would have accepted the Maori's offer, but paying pilot fees and towage was against my principle in the Tillicum. Apart from this, my time was getting short, and I was anxious to make Auckland. Otherwise, we would certainly have called in and availed ourselves of the opportunity to visit that historical place. The southwest point of the bay near which we drifted is called Young Nick's Head, named after a boy who belonged to the great navigator's crew and first saw the land. The small river, Taranganui, flows into Poverty Bay, and this is the celebrated spot where Captain Cook first touched New Zealand soil. In the immediate surroundings of this place, he met with inhospitable natives, and although he made them presents and employed every means to be friendly, they remained hostile, and the crew of the Endeavour, his ship, had on various occasions to resort to arms for protection. These unlucky circumstances and his unsuccessful attempt to obtain provisions caused him to apply the name Poverty Bay. At the present time, the flourishing town of Gisborne is situated on the shores of the bay, and the neighbourhood looks so prosperous that, judging from what I could see from a distance, it is about time to change the old name. We had drifted about near Young Nick's Head for several hours when a fresh breeze came in from the southwest, which took us up to the East Cape. Rounding the latter, we shaped our course across the Bay of Plenty, named so by Captain Cook in March of 1770, because of the number of people seen on the fringing coast. The wind kept fair and fresh, and we soon passed Great Barrier Island on our starboard, and having crossed Hauraki Gulf, arrived at Auckland on July the 20th, 1903. Auckland is the largest city in New Zealand, and at the time the Tillicum called, had a population of about 67,000. As at other places in Australasia, at which I had called, almost every second man I met was interested in yachting. And if one considers the splendid subtropical climate and the great cruising grounds available, I think there is no place on the globe that surpasses Auckland in water sport facilities. The cruising season here begins in September and ends in May. The other 3 months constitute the winter, during which period the yachts are hauled out of the water for repairing and cleaning. As our time of call coincided with the winter season, I did not sail in one of the yachts. However, I was honoured by some of the Auckland's yachtsmen being taken round in a launch to various places where the yachts were hauled up, and considering the number of pleasure boats and launches I saw that day, it would seem that nearly every man, woman and child in that fair city must be devoted to yachting. We had spent about a fortnight in Auckland when my mate Buckridge suddenly announced, "Captain, you better look for another mate, as I have to leave you." This, of course, took me by surprise, and I asked, "What is the matter with you? Only a few days ago you told me that this is the best layover you ever got into, and now that we have passed through all that bad dirty weather and intend to sail for the tropics, you're going to leave me?" "Well, it is not that I am dissatisfied in any way," he assured me, "but I have made up my mind to build a boat of my own and of about the same size as the Tillicum to race you to England." As I have stated before, he took part in the South African campaign and afterwards joined Captain Scott's expedition to the South Pole, but he had no knowledge of navigation and very little practical seamanship. As I was well aware of his weak points in this respect, I advised him strongly not to attempt such a voyage. To make a cruise round the world in your own vessel and go as you please certainly looks most inviting, and for myself I do not hesitate to say that the 3 years spent in the Tillicum, in spite of her small dimensions, was the most enjoyable time of my life. But in order to make the cruise a success, the man in charge requires an absolutely thorough knowledge of practical navigation, and he must be able to handle a small vessel in all kinds of weather. And it is by no means sufficient for him to understand when a boat is correctly built, rigged, ballasted, and provided with the proper sails and all gear necessary to weather heavy gales. He must also be a good judge of the weather, as barometers are very unreliable at times. More especially is this necessary when the boat is near land and there is no harbour in which to seek shelter from an approaching gale. The safety of the vessel and life may then depend on a quick decision to sail off the land in order to obtain sufficient sea room before the gale compels you to heave to. It is further essential that the boat be fitted with good water tanks to ensure an efficient supply of pure drinking water, and a complete list of stores must be secured as there are no roadhouses at sea. Apart from being an experienced seaman, the yachtsman who ventures on the high seas must also be a good cook, for owing to the small dimensions of his boat, physical exercise is limited, and to keep in good condition, all food must be intelligently selected and properly cooked. It is also a factor of considerable importance to adhere to regular meal hours in all kinds of weather. By understanding and attending to these points, an ocean cruise is, in my opinion, the most enjoyable and healthy pastime a man could possibly choose. But it would be a foolhardy undertaking for one who is not qualified or who is ignorant of the dangers involved to venture on his own account. A miserable spell would probably end in an early disaster. As I have already observed, Mr. Buckridge could not claim to be an experienced seaman, but ignoring my advice, he placed an order with a yacht builder in Auckland for a boat of about 4 tons, in which he proposed to proceed to England. Unfortunately, this left me again without a mate. However, I was lucky enough to pick a strong, healthy young man whose name was W. Russell from a number of applicants. At this juncture, it may be advisable to mention that the authorities of all ports I called at never interfered with me, and whenever I engaged a new mate, the agreement was generally of a private character. My plan was to sail after leaving Auckland by way of some South Sea islands, through the Torres Strait and the Arafura Sea, across the Indian Ocean to Durban, South Africa, i.e. a distance of about 15,000 miles. Bearing in mind the length of the voyage, I was especially careful in selecting a reliable man and a good companion. When Mr. Russell applied in person, I catechized him after this manner. Where were you born? In Ireland. How old are you? 25 years. Have you ever been to sea as a sailor or in any other capacity? As a passenger only. What is your profession? I was trained for the church. Are you still following that profession? No, I lost my job some time ago. Have you done any yacht sailing? Yes. Can you steer one? Yes. Can you tell a good story? This last question was put before the candidate, and as he answered it by telling me a real crackerjack right on the spot, Mr. Russell was engaged for the voyage to South Africa. To replace my broken chronometer, I bought a new Waltham watch, which afterwards proved reliable and did excellent service throughout the remainder of my voyage. In a city like Auckland, with its yachting population, pleasure and splendour, time quickly passes, and ere I realised it, we were well into August, and it was time for the Tillicum to put to sea again. The little vessel had once more been favoured with a smile from the goddess of luck, as some Auckland yachtsmen had kindly presented her with a new set of rigging, running gear, and many other smaller articles which afterwards proved of great value on the long voyage. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.